Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to the third and final of our YouthWork Summit sessions that we're doing here at the Greenberg Festival. YouthWork Summit is an event which I'll tell you a little bit about in a moment. But my name is Martin Saunders. I'm the editor of YouthWork magazine and also one of the founders of a national YouthWork event called the YouthWork Summit. The first night I was here, I couldn't find my tent and so I had to sleep somewhere random. Last night, I got and found my tent and discovered that all my baggage had been waterlogged, so I had no clean clothes. And I feel that's why I'm wearing this T-shirt, because clearly something's not fitting here, in more ways than one. And so I just want to make that very clear from the start. I don't really know who this is. I believe he's called JZ or something. But I think a lot of people, Harry Baker is actually folding over double of what he's just seen. Yeah? So I'm down with the kids. And that's quite apt, because this session is about youth cultures. See what I did there. So the YouthWork Summit is a new kind of YouthWork training event. We've done, I think, three of them so far. You're very warmly welcome to the next one, which is in May in West Bromwich. We spend a day and we talk. We have lots and lots of people talk for 5, 10 or 15 minutes, and that's what we're going to have. We're going to have a sort of mini YouthWork Summit here on the subject of youth cultures right now. Now, apart from the format, the other thing you really need to know about the YouthWork Summit is that we are all about breadth and inclusivity, and we recognize that there are lots and lots of different people in lots of contexts from lots of different theologies and backgrounds who are doing Christian youth work in some way or shape or form. And so what we want to do is represent lots and lots of different people and bring them together in terms of the speakers, but also in terms of the delegates. And so hopefully you'll hear stuff that new voices that you've never heard before. You'll be inspired, you'll be challenged. Hopefully you'll hear something you frankly disagree with, because we wouldn't be taking enough risks if you didn't. So that's the idea. That's what we're going to do today. The subject for this one is youth cultures. It's not youth culture because obviously that's not really a thing anymore. But it's probably the broadest topic we could possibly try to tackle. And so you will see there will be some theme, but obviously because of the size of the theme, we're going to be talking about all sorts of aspects of youth cultures. So enjoy what you're going to get here. You're going to have five different speakers, which is, I think, the most we've had all week, and also a performance from world champion Harry Baker and fan. Who is this? Jay-Z. He's not Jay-Z. Clearly neither am I. But thank you. Our first speakers are Louise Detain and Chantelle Gray, who are both youth workers who run Outburst, which is a large LGBT youth group in Nottingham, and they're also both involved in Outer Space. So the first talk is on how you can welcome and support LGBT young people in your youth group. So please welcome Louise and Chantelle.
Not everyone in your youth group is straight. I can pretty much guarantee that if you have more than about 5 or 10 young people, chances are you have an LGBT young person in your youth group. And for those of you that don't know, LGBT stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgendered. Everyone in my youth group is not straight. We run a youth group for LGBT young people. And it's a wonderful place. It's a wonderful place. They love coming. And they're brilliant. They're a brilliant group of young people. I've been doing youth work for 14 years. For the last 2 years, I've been running Outburst. Before that, I worked for a charity. I worked with runaways and young people that were in trouble in some way or another with a charity. I've worked for the local authority doing youth work. And previously to that, I worked for nearly 8 years as a youth pastor of a large church near Nottingham.
My name's Louise Detain. I have done youth work, I think like lots of youth workers in churches, since I was youth. At about 18, I got involved in the 11 to 14s work in my church, and I've kind of done different kinds of youth work ever since. I started doing LGBT youth work in London for a local authority in about 2009, and I've done LGBT youth work ever since. And I moved to Nottingham in December 2010, and I got involved in Outburst and now work for Outburst, which is the LGBT youth group there. And we're both foster carers, actually.
Yeah. We're going to tell you our stories of what it's like to be an LGBT young person in a church, which is not always the easiest thing to do. I didn't get involved in church until I was an older teenager. I came from a family that were not interested in Christianity at all, and to be fair, neither was I. And then I met somebody who went to a church, they took me to church, and I thought it was amazing. And in quite a short period of time, I spent a lot of time looking into the Bible and Christianity and what that was all about, and decided I wanted to be a Christian and got involved in my local youth group as a lesbian. They didn't know I was a lesbian, but I was a lesbian, they didn't know. And I loved my youth group, I loved my church, and I was very enthusiastic. And actually, I was a pretty much the kind of kid anybody would want to get into their youth group. I turned up and I was got involved, and I helped out on various rotas, and I was really enthusiastic, and I turned up at all the Bible studies and the prayer meetings, and Sunday morning and Sunday evening, and I put the chairs out, and all that good stuff that you want young people to do in church. I did all of that. And then after being in church for quite a while, I took a year out and I served my church for a year. And then a little while after that, I went on to run the youth group. I ended up being their youth pastor for over, like I said, over 8 years. And the whole time I was in that church, no one knew that I was gay. And that was for me, that was a really, really difficult thing. I was involved in a Pentecostal church that was not very LGBT friendly at all. I knew where my church stood on the issues. And I loved God and wanted to serve God, and therefore thought the best thing for me to do was not to be gay. I tried really hard not to be gay, really hard. And because of that decision, and because of how my church was, I actually made some really bad life choices. And being in church was really difficult for me, even though I love church, I love my youth group. I ran a really successful youth group, and I loved my youth group then. But it was really difficult for me being in that church. Eventually, cut a long story a bit short, I found myself in a relationship with a wonderful woman who also went to the church. And when the church found out that I was gay, my church fired me on the spot. They fired me on the spot, told me to leave and never to come back to that church again. I wasn't even allowed to say goodbye to my youth group. And I'm all right, I'm absolutely fine now. No worries, I'm getting on very well with my life. But what I wanted to say was, it's difficult being an LGBT young person in a church. It's difficult not knowing if you're welcome. It's difficult not knowing if the person who you are is acceptable to God and acceptable to your youth workers, your church leaders, people who you love, people who are your friends. And that's a really difficult place to be. And I think the main thing I wanted to say is, I feel that I am really, really lucky and really blessed. I've kept my faith. I walked away from that church and I've kept my faith. I still love God. I still want to serve God. And I walked away and kept my faith. But hundreds of LGBT young people walk away from churches every day and they don't keep their faith, and they feel like they're not welcome in churches and they're not accepted by God. And that leads to some pretty awful things happening. Losing their faith, kind of the lowest scale. Horrible things happen because LGBT young people don't think they're welcome. In our youth group now, we have exceptional number of young people that go to churches and sit at the back and don't want anyone to know that they're gay, and other young people that, if they felt they were welcome, would be in your churches, definitely. In fact, Greenbelt gave us some tickets to bring some young people with us, and we have some young people from Outburst here with us, and they're loving it, they're having a fantastic time. But it's really important how we welcome LGBT young people into our churches, because so many of them walk away and lose their faith. And I'm standing here today as someone that didn't, and I'm really, really lucky to be in that place. Louise is going to tell you her story.
I grew up I think my faith journey is a little bit of we might sort of call it a pick and mix. Let's find which denomination I feel comfortable in. I grew up in a Catholic family. My dad is a deacon within the Catholic Church, and up until recently working as a hospital chaplain. At 16, I moved on to what my parents would thought of as the dark side. I moved into an Anglican church, which was very evangelical. Similar to Chantelle, I was the young person you'd want in your church. I was a youth worker. I was on the worship team. And like Chantelle, nobody would have guessed that I was gay. Nobody in a million years. I was there, I loved God, and I still do. But actually, in that situation, I spent a lot of my time from about the age of 12 to when I came out at 21, knowing really that I was not attracted to men in the same way my friends were, but I couldn't describe that. I had no words. I knew no one who was gay, or I probably did, but I didn't know that myself. I spent about 5 or 6 years in this very large evangelical Anglican church with the underlying message. It was never, except when we did the sex talk, the annual sex talk, we never really talked about sexuality. It was never really discussed that actually it's quite usual for even straight young people to have attractions to people of the same gender. All that was just something that I thought was only me. I became involved in a group for young lesbian and gay Christians online, but never went to any of their sessions because I was convinced that they would try to convert me. And I thought maybe it was some sneaky underground movement to convert the gays. I was convinced that nobody would ever accept me, including my family, who I have to say have been wonderful and loving and love my partner and love me. I moved away. I joined a Christian organisation, which I did a very late gap year. I did about 6 gap years in succession. And I joined a Christian organisation. I'm one of those young people because I'm on another gap year. I joined a Christian organisation and met my partner there. And we've had a civil partnership since 2008. I was 21 when I met her. And I was convinced it was wrong, but actually spent a lot of time looking further and learning and rereading the Bible and reading literature, and it changed my life. Coming to Greenbelt made me feel accepted. I met other gay people. I met Chantelle and her partner, and I met other younger people, but also older people who'd had such different stories to me, but so similar too. And coming to Greenbelt changed that. Like Chantelle, I'm lucky. I walked away from what could have been a terrible situation. Similarly, when the Christian organisation heard that my partner and I were together, they were less than amused, and it became impossible to work there. We still love that organisation, but it was difficult. It was hard, and we decided to leave. Both my partner and I, walked away with our faith. We're involved in a Methodist church. I found a church that would let me serve them in their youth ministry and in their worship ministry, which was a blessing. But I, too, meet young people all the time who identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, who think God hates them. And I think that's the saddest thing. I don't think God hates anybody. And young people who don't want to hear, their ears are just so sealed shut to the fact that God could love them. And that's so sad. And so Chantelle and I, in our work, it's a secular youth group, but in our work we work really hard to make sure that the young people who want to know more about faith and spirituality have the tools to do so. And that's why we've brought them here this weekend.
We wanted to leave you with a challenge. Like we said, not everyone in your youth group is straight, even if you don't know so. Not everyone is. We put together these small leaflets. We spent a long time talking about what we would talk to you about. We would have loved to have done long sessions on LGBT and the Bible and all of those things, but we've got 10 minutes, so we didn't have time. We wanted to leave you with a few quick challenges. If you want to make your youth group more inclusive to LGBT people, you need to look at how you welcome those people into your group. How are people welcomed into your group, especially young people that are obviously LGBT? To be actually inclusive, I've been to so many churches. When I left my church, I went on a Let's Find a Church journey and went to about 15 churches and had a range of answers. I had churches that were worried if I came to their church, I'd try and get involved in their youth group, and then I would be a child protection issue. I've been called a child protection issue, which I think is quite funny, as that's all I've ever done. All I've ever done is youth work. To be actually inclusive, an LGBT young person needs to be able to have the same opportunity to do anything any other young person would be able to do in your group. So if a young person can rise to be a junior leader, then an LGBT young person needs to be able to rise to be a junior leader. If a young person can lead worship, then an LGBT young person needs to be able to lead worship. If they can't, your youth group isn't inclusive. You need to be obviously inclusive. If you want these young people that we work with and that are all around your towns and cities to know they're welcome at your church, you need to be obviously inclusive. They hear all the time on the radio and the TV, people saying, oh, God hates gays, gay people can't go to church. If you want them to come, you need them to know that your group's inclusive. So make sure it's on your Facebook page, on your information, on your term cards, on your website, that LGBT young people can come to your church, your youth group, your organisation, and they will be welcome. Make sure the language you use is inclusive. Like Louise was saying, in the annual sex talk, make sure it's not just, oh, when you grow up and you meet a boy and fall in love, or you meet a girl and fall in love. Just that kind of language can really exclude LGBT young people, because maybe the boy you're talking to, when he grows up, he's going to meet the man of his dreams and not the woman of his dreams. And never, ever accept homophobic language in your youth group. That is amazingly hurtful to young people who are gay. And lastly, encourage young people to think for themselves. Encourage them. Give them the tools to look at the issues, to learn about what the Bible says and what it's like to be an LGBT young person. Give the young people the tools and encourage them to think for themselves. If you can't do anything else, that's probably the best thing you could ever do for a young person, to say, here's the information, look into it for yourself, think for yourself. And again, in your church, it might be difficult to think for yourself on some issues if your church is quite straight down the line on some issues. But again, I would encourage you just to think for yourself, not to agree with Louise and I, but just to look into the issues and think for yourself. Come up with your own opinions. When you have an opinion, what backs that opinion up? Look into it for yourselves. We'll be handing these out on the door, so if you've got any questions for us, we'll be there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Louise and Chantel. And just if you do have questions, it will be great if at the end we could try and take some. So if you have one for Louise or Chantel, then make a note of it now as we go. And we'll try and take questions at the end. On the first of these, we had one question. And it was really embarrassing. So just don't want to put that pressure on you, but it was really hard for me to look at a sea of blank stares. So, you know, you could do better than that, couldn't you? In a minute, Harry Baker and I are going to do a rap together. But first... I'd like you to welcome Jessie Jo Jacobs, who is the Chief Executive of A Way Out, a charity helping women and young people with addictions or who have been sexually exploited. Her talk is called either Sex, Drugs and Video Games or just Addiction. So she thought the first one was better. So this is Sex, Drugs and Video Games. Please welcome Jessie Jo Jacobs.
Hi, it's great to be with you. It's really good to be able to kind of get this on the agenda, because I think it's such an important conversation that we need to be having with, if we work with young people, if we're in a relationship with young people, because actually for many of you, if you are involved in youth work, you'll know that our role is becoming increasingly complex. You're not only a kind of church youth worker, you're also maybe expected to, as well as offering spiritual support, you need to be trained drugs workers, sexual health workers, social workers, and even counsellors. Because actually, we live in a kind of a messed up society, and a lot of young people are struggling with issues. And we only have to look at kind of some of the statistics around kind of drugs and alcohol. I'm from the northeast, and in the last kind of 8 years, we saw a 600% increase in the amount of liver disease amongst young people. That's due to kind of binge drinking and youth. Many people won't know this, but the statistics around kind of deaths by alcohol are massively increasing, and there's doubled in hospitalisations, from 500,000 to 1 million hospitalisations every year, and a large proportion of those are young people. But I wanted to even mention kind of video games, because video games are just part of youth culture. It's kind of what we do, but actually even those can become addicted, and I haven't got enough time to kind of go into how normal behaviour, how something as normal as sex can become harmful, or how something as normal as video games can become harmful. But I guess what I wanted to raise is that there are certain behaviours and certain things that young people are getting hooked to. And that's what I kind of deal with in my charity. Our charity is called A Way Out. And I actually started this project 10 years ago whilst I was a Christian youth worker. It was my first night, actually, of doing Christian youth work. And I was in a big kind of evangelical church, and there's about 200 young people in there. It was quite a middle class church, and all these young people were kind of like bouncing about to the music, and they were all having what looked like a really good night. But there's a certain part of the night when I'd kind of just closed my eyes, and when I did, it was like a reflective moment, you know, and they put the like meditative music on. But for me, when it happened, like I just closed my eyes, and what I saw was a young person. But the young person that I saw wasn't jumping about and having a good time. She was actually on a street corner, and it was a young girl, and she was selling her body into prostitution. And what I saw was her being picked up by a guy in a car. And I knew that girl was kind of out there. It was just a reality that in the same town, the young people are living dramatically different lives. And I kind of asked the question, well, where's the church? Where are these young people? Who's protecting these young people? Why are they there in the first place? And that kind of took me on a journey to start a project. And over the last 10 years, we basically just started to go out onto the streets, and sure enough, we found 15-year-olds who were caught up in sexual exploitation, and a lot of it was to do with addiction, and in a lot of the younger girls' cases, it was an older man who'd actually got them hooked on drugs and was now sending them out onto the streets. And it really just kind of broke my heart, but we started to work around kind of, well, what can we do in this situation? To start off with, I'd love to have questions later to go into more detail about some of that stuff, but just to kind of look at, well, what is addiction? I guess there's two ways of its description. It's a compulsive psychological need for a habit-forming substance, or in more general terms, it's described as the condition of being habitually or compulsively occupied with or involved in something. And there's different types of addiction. So you've got substance addiction, which is the one that you most would likely hear about: drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, caffeine, solvents, and food. But there's also activity addictions, thought addictions. Activity addictions are things like gambling, sex, food and eating, and exercise, computer games. The things that you do that you become addicted or dependent or habitual behaviours. Thought addictions, worrying, compulsive, obsessive thinking, perfectionism, emotional addiction such as anger, fear and rage, and it's actually possible to become addicted to anger, and also people addictions, and that might be kind of sex and relationships, and the whole kind of needing to be in a relationship, needing to be in a sexual relationship to sort of meet a need instead of it being healthy relationships. And quite often in studies of addictions, addiction is described as a tree, and all these things are the branches, but actually you've got roots. And what we found in our experience, and obviously this isn't, every person who gets addicted doesn't have a deep-rooted problem, but what we find more often than not is that there are often root causes to a lot of the addictions that we deal with, and that might be kind of parental trauma. It could be kind of bullying, but there's actually been studies about if the brain has kind of been damaged through trauma, it can actually be wired up for addiction. So that's when you can get quite a normal behaviour, but coupled with a brain that's been through trauma, it's much more likely to become addicted. So what can we do as youth workers in these situations? How can we even begin to kind of protect our young people or help our young people? Well, I think one of the things that we do really well as churches is that we develop good relationships. Some of the most effective prevention and intervention models are based on when you have a good and strong relationship with your kind of worker. But I'd kind of challenge that to go further. What I want to see is that a church that has good, open and honest relationships, that we can become a non-judgmental unit. We're not going to be the holier-than-thou Christian youth worker that a young person doesn't feel that they can tell you something, because you might be the closest person in their lives, but if they can see that you are going to judge them, then they're going to be much less likely to tell you what's going on. But the biggest thing that we can do is we can start to get some of these issues out in the open. I can guarantee that you will have someone in your youth groups who is self-harming, eating disorders, cannabis or alcohol. You will have an addiction in your youth group, and what will probably happen is it'll be going unspoken about. So the first thing that we can do is we can create a culture of honesty within our churches and within our youth groups, and for all sorts, practice honesty as well. And so when we can create non-judgmental, honest environments, then we can get some of these issues. And also the power of the right question. Quite often in sort of child abuse cases, there was youth workers that were working with young people, but they never were asked the right question. And sometimes we might skate around the subject. As an organisation, we do something really simple. We call it the health and wellbeing form. It sounds a bit boring, but what it is just five questions. Are you happy? Are you healthy? Have you got a good relationship? Are you engaging? And I can't remember the fifth one. But basically, it's like just five simple questions. Check in. How are you doing? And you know, around health. How are you doing around your relationships? And it just gets us into a habit of asking the right questions. Get clued up. Young people can suss you out really quickly. If they want to go to someone for advice, they're going to look for who they think is a credible source of that advice. And so if you're kind of as a youth worker, we need to make it our practice to go on the internet and find out what's happening around young people. But be honest, if you don't know that information, know where you can go. Getting tooled up and clued up is so important. There are so many organisations out there that can help with situations. You can bring in organisations who can do the talk, as it were. But also there's kind of get connected with your secular agencies. Like, there are some amazing works that are out there. There are funded projects that are there specifically to help young people with addictions. And they need referrals. And they're also really equipped to deal with some of these issues. So find out who your local drugs workers are, who your local projects are, and link up. And they'll be really, they'll be really pleased to work in partnership with the church. Fifthly, I want to talk about getting healed up, because in my experience, my background actually was I had some kind of addictions myself, and one of the biggest ways that I was able to deal with that is that I got healed up. And quite often, as young people, if we have been through trauma, what we need to do is be able to deal with the root. And so where better than a church that looks at spiritual, emotional and well-being of an individual to be able to encourage our young people to get healed up, encourage them to have a living relationship with Jesus. For me, it was kind of knowing the love of a father, and also dealing with some of my past forgiveness stuff that made a real transformative difference in my own life. And what I see in our project time and time and time again is that the way that we see our young people get freed is when they get healed, and it's having counselling, it's being able to look at those sort of deep rooted issues and get them to the surface and get them dealt with, and even if the behaviour, they haven't even got to a point where they are engaging in addictive behaviours, we should still be thinking about getting healed up, being as whole as we can, because then they're going to be much less likely to be getting hooked into some of these behaviours. Thanks.
Okay, now for something completely different. At the YouthWorks Summit, we don't just ask people to sort of stand up the front and talk. We're also interested in some different kinds and forms of communication, and you're going to hear something very different and special now. We have a world champion in our midst this afternoon. There is something called, I didn't know this existed, if I'm honest, the Poetry Slam World Cup, in which 90 different countries represent? 19, all right. I've over-egged it a bit. Should we say 90? A lot of countries compete. And top of the pile, world champion Mr. Harry Baker. So please welcome him.
If people don't know what a poetry slam is, it was come up with in America as a way of tricking people into going to poetry events by putting an exciting word like slam on the end. But I like them because it kind of meant there was more interaction with the audience, because the audience ultimately got to vote. I was going to do something else, but I can't resist because of the Jay-Z. So before I did poetry, I used to be a rapper, as you can probably tell by my swag. But I was always told you should stick to what you know, and it's just, if there's a message in this one, it's stick to what you know. But so instead of writing raps about killing people or driving my fast cars over people, I used to write raps about playing with Lego, doing a newspaper round, and maths. So in maths, if you're familiar with the concept of a Venn diagram, imagine this bit is maths, and this bit is Jay-Z. I'm kind of going for that niche market in the middle. But imagine I look cooler. I've got my calculator on statistics mode, pencil and protractor and I'm ready to go. They say that I'm a loser with no life and no hope, but I'm a mathematician. What type of facts are those? If you grow with some since you were 3 1/3 and could be talented with numbers without being a nerd, cause to me, that don't seem irrational like surds. And if you don't like my logic, then just listen to my words. Now I may not be normal like a distribution curve, but if I don't fit in, well, I don't give a standard deviation. They call me the denominator because I divide crowds like hyperbolic equations. Yes, I don't know what you take me as. Honestly, the intelligence that I might have, but from fractions to decimals, I ain't dumb. I've got 99 problems, but maths ain't one. Hit me. 99 problems, but maths ain't one. And if you're having number problems, I feel bad for you, son. I've got 99 problems, but maths ain't one. Hit me. And the backing dance. 99 problems, but maths ain't one. Now check me recite pilot, Mr. Palfreyman. It's my maths teacher. 99 problems, but maths ain't one. And break it down for the pi solo like 3.1415926535896 3238463684626 4883279 5 2 8 4 1 9 7 1 6 9 3 9 9 3 7 5 1 0 5 That's 51 decimal places, and I've got a few more. Hit them with the 820974 9445 0781. I've got 99 problems, but maths ain't one. Hit me. Thanks. I'll do a poem. I am a man. Sometimes I put my manhood on display, like going skinny dipping in the sea on New Year's Day. I've gone up for thirds in an all-you-can-eat buffet, and I have not once worried about how much I weigh. I am a man. Sometimes I do manly things. Not to prove I'm a man, but that's just part of what it brings. When I stay at playing FIFA on my PS3 till 4, it's not because I'm insecure, it's because it's fun. And some say that real men are brave men. And brave men are cavemen, and cavemen are men who do not really show emotion. I say if something is real, that's something you can feel, and that could be love, religion, fear, or uncertainty, because real men have issues, and real men cry. That's why they make man-sized tissues for their man-sized eyes, and I cry quite a lot. And in this day and age, when men's eyes are drawn on the terms that he may be gay, but I am not. I like a girl, I just cry like a girl at certain things and the hurt it brings. And my main form of catharsis is Pixar flicks. The reason that I see them in the cinemas is so you cannot see my tears behind those 3D glasses, because I broke down in Up. And I wept in Toy Story 3. Was on the brink in Monsters, Inc. And Cars did the same thing to me. When watching Wall-E, I wasn't worried about which of my friends Willy's was bigger, because something in an animation puts an emotional trigger and you may snigger. If you see these guns, are not the manliest. But I figure that in the best way to measure manliness, because real men have issues, and real men cry as well to make man-sized tissues, not to be misused by never been kissed youths in dimly lit rooms searching YouTube for big boobs. But for the man-sized tears that run for man-sized eyes, and the last one I used was watching Sky News when the story came through of a kid named Jordan Rice in Australia. In the worst floods in years that reduced many men to floods of tears and faced with death, he didn't hesitate or take a breath, just gave his life for his brother. So I cried for the brother who died for another age 13. The age a boy steps into manhood, he really could fit his boots as well as any man could, because real men are brave, right? Well, they don't get much braver. So yes, I am 19, I'm not the most prolific shaver. If anything, I only really weekly need a razor. Maybe bi-weekly. And not as in twice weekly. As in once every 2 weeks, possibly slightly longer. Sometimes I am too weak and I wish I could be stronger. I did Movember and nobody even noticed. Twice. But know this, I am a man. As are about half of you, statistically. regardless, I was doing press ups all afternoon. When I was 13, I stand on my head to the sky was green and the grass was blue. Then somewhere in this path I grew, so yes, I'm still a kid at heart and not ready to grow up. And if I go to Nando's, I drink too much Coke and throw up. But here's something we can raise those refillable glasses to. Because growing up is something not every kid gets a chance to do. Cheers.
So just to sort of cover my mistake, right, had there been 90 countries, he still would have won. Yeah. Harry Baker. And I think he's coming to the Youth Work Summit in May again. I reckon he's going to do it again. So our next speaker is Richard Passmore, who is, among other things, the author of one of the best books I've ever read on youth work, which is, I don't know if it's still in print. That's not what it's called. is it still in print?
Kindle.
It's on Kindle, and it's called Meet Them Where They're At, and it's absolutely brilliant. I really recommend it to you if you're interested in issues around detached youth work. But he works for Frontier Youth Trust, and he heads up the Street Space community, and he's here to talk to us about pulse rate research. So please welcome Richard Passmore.
Thank you. My pulse rate research really is my sabbatical. I needed an excuse to go to America and go on holiday and have an extended holiday and hopefully get a bit of money to help me do that kind of holiday. So basically what I did was I went to America to try and take a kind of cultural pulse rate of America, and I built on a research technique that I developed with young people in this country. And much to the kind of embarrassment of my children, well, they got a good holiday out of it, but to the embarrassment of my children, we drove across America, and every time we stopped anywhere or went to visit anything, I would turn to my left and turn to my right and ask some random Americans two critical questions. And the first question that I would ask them was, what word is most important in your life? And the second question that I would ask them was, what word best describes your life? And the premise of the research was that there's a cultural time lag between the effect of American culture that has on Western culture, and particularly in the UK context. There's this thing called cultural signifiers, which you will be familiar with, things like film and different aspects of culture. And what I wanted to kind of look at was, what's the cultural pulse rate of America that's happening at the moment that's going to be coming over here in the next few years, so that we as youth workers can begin to ask the critical questions and address and help our young people to address the critical factors that are coming and shaping their culture over the next 4 or 5 years. And so I travelled across America. We landed in New York, and I drove to Niagara. We went through Indiana to sample some of the kind of Amish community and the Hutterite community and some of the kind of sections of that. We then hit Chicago, and we did Route 66 all the way across to Vegas, which was an interesting experience with a five-year-old. We did some other bits. We did some Navajo country to kind of take a bit of different Native American sampling as well. And basically every time I was in the cinema, I asked these questions, and I tried to offer money to my daughter and my son to go and ask and help me with the research, but they were not having any of it. What was it, the critical things that came out? What we did with the few hundred words that we collected was, I then, when I got to California, I got the young people, I worked with a group of young people to theme those words into three or four significant themes that they thought summarized all of the key themes that were emerging. And I haven't got time to kind of go into all of those, but I'll tell you the overarching theme. And the overarching theme was, in the word that is most important to you, the predominant answers were things like relationships and families. And in the words that what best describes your life was busy, hectic kind of lifestyle. And I think we already see a bit of that in the UK, but I think it's going to only advance as the kind of work and terms, conditions and all of that shift with the recession and the kind of current culture we're into. And so the question is how do we as youth workers enable young people to critically reflect on the life that they want to have, versus the life that they are leading. Because the culture that's coming is saying that actually it's going to be very hard to lead the type of life that you want to lead with the values that you have at the core of your worldview that might be about faith or hope or justice or family or all the great things that Greenbelt goes on about. But actually it's going to be very hard to live those. And somehow, how do we develop a critical consciousness with young people about that, and how do we do that? And I was going to tell you about the kind of the power of story as a critical way of doing that today, and give you some kind of good quotes about language and story and how we can have an unfolding kind of language and story and habitus to do that. But actually, I think the biggest gift we have in this is in this room already, and that's from lesbian and gay young people. And as workers who are experienced in helping young people who have an ability to help them live the type of life that they need to live and be themselves and be whole and holistic and live in that way, your biggest asset is actually to get to know lesbian and gay and transgender young people and workers and work out what are the tools that they're using to help young people identify and live the lives that they need to use and live and be. And I would kind of advocate to you to get to know them. Get to know lesbian, gay and transsexual workers. Get to know that whole field. Because actually the culture that's coming is going to be a massive challenge to the young people that we work with, just everyday young people in your youth work. And there are other things that we can do to kind of challenge that, but we have a gift here. So use this as an opportunity to build some context, build some networks, and kind of take it from there.
Brilliant. Thank you, Richard. I just want to remind you at the end, we're going to be taking questions. Would be great if you had some. That would really help that whole process, if you think about it. And we have one more speaker before that. If I can say nothing else about Jamie Cutteridge, it's that he has appalling taste in T-shirts. But he lent me this one. So at least I'm not at least, if you think of the alternative, it wouldn't look or smell good. Please welcome the local church youth worker and the journalist for Youth Work magazine, who's going to talk to us about football, even if you don't like football. And that's it. I mean that in a good way. So it's even if you don't like football, there's still something you can get out of this. It's Jamie Cutteridge, What Youth Work Can Learn from Football.
Ace. Everyone else has got an iPhone to tell themselves. I've got a Casio watch. I didn't learn anything about community from church. Sharing the peace with people never did it for me. Bring and share lunches once a term where it's just tables full of quiche didn't do community for me. Not even the church weekend away quite did it. I didn't learn anything about community from church. Instead, everything I learnt about community, I learnt from a load of sweary, drunk, abusive, and at times plain offensive football fans. And the roots of this kind of knowledge of community and where that came from one of those big, life-changing decisions that you hear about at Christian festivals, the kind of decisions you make that loses some friends, that alienates some people you know, and brings you new friends. Yes, a few years ago, I changed my football team. I know. Honestly. Though, interestingly, the reason behind changing the football team came from the kind of reasons that other people would change their church. Because far from feeling like a valid part of the club that I was attending, I felt like a consumer. I felt like I was only there to observe rather than play a part. And it seems to me like churches and football have reached a bit of a similar point, that we can go along to football and we can go along to church and feel like consumers. We can just be there to take what we want and not really play a part. And what's really interesting, if we work on the assumption that football and church are kind of in the same place, is that they've kind of gone on the same journey. So if you look at the history of the church, the early church was all about community. We see that in Acts 2 and Acts 4, this community who are of one heart and one mind and had all their things in common to provide for those that needed it. And this focus on community was born out of the ministry of Jesus, born out of the fact that so much of what Jesus did was about bringing people into the kingdom, be it the people that needed healing because they were seen as unclean, be it the women who were alienated from their societies, or the tax collectors whose jobs meant that no one would talk to them. The early church took this and held it central to what they did. And over the next 2,000 years, the church had ups and downs. But it seems like the move to a more consumerist form of church has happened as a product of the culture around us. As if, just like everywhere else in society, we feel happy enough to turn up to church, get what we need, and leave. And similarly from the church, the roots of football came from a community base. It evolved out of a mob game that involved the entirety of a local community. And from this, small clubs were born, often out of existing social institutions like churches or cricket clubs. And football provided an outlet for the existing community and social organisation. Since their formation in the late 19th and early 20th century, football clubs kind of allowed a town to put its identity into something. They became a focal point for the formation and expression of local identities. Now, I don't know how much football you watch, but this doesn't seem to me like the game of football we see today. The game of football at the top flight seems all about money, it seems all about business, it seems all about a product, and somehow it's gone away from that community route in perhaps the same way that some of our churches have. So my question is, are we beginning to see this same business-focused consumer shift in church? My answer to that, when I look around, unfortunately, is yes. Are members of our communities turning into consumers? And are our young people happy to turn up, get what they want, and leave? Here's the encouraging bit. Football fans are beginning to kick up a bit of a fuss. There are a few other people like me who I've met who have abandoned the Premiership, abandoned the top flight football, and gone down looking for smaller clubs, looking to put community back into football, to find places that do community better. In a society where many of the traditional homes of community are disappearing, people are realising that the need for community wherever they can find it. And so I wrote a dissertation last year, and I decided I wanted to explore the things that made community work. What made football clubs do community well, and what could the church learn from that? And there were two overarching things that helped build strong community. One of them is really obvious, and it's size. If you've got less people at a football club, it's easier for everyone to get to know each other just from number of relationships. And so I surveyed a load of Kingstonian fans, of which there are about 300 at a match day, and Arsenal fans who have got 60,000 on a match day. And it's no surprise at all to tell you that central to the reason that Kingstonian fans went to games of football was a sense of community and the people they went with. For Arsenal fans, it wasn't. It was about the product they were going to see. It was about seeing their favourite players and out of a sense of routine. So I don't think that's particularly interesting. I don't think any of you will be surprised that smaller football clubs do community better. The interesting bit are the anomalies amongst these. So amongst the bigger clubs, there were two or three teams who seemed to have more importance on community than their peers. And these two were Liverpool and Man United. Their fans more than double placed a lot of importance on community and the people they go with compared to, say, Arsenal, Chelsea or Spurs, who are clubs of a similar size. And what's interesting about Liverpool and Man United is that central to those clubs is a narrative, is a story that those clubs and fans kind of bound together around. So for Man United, I don't want to bore you with footballing history, but during the 50s, there was a plane crash when their team was leaving Munich, and they lost a generation's worth of players. And that's still remembered at Old Trafford today. You go to Old Trafford, there's a clock that stopped at the time it was, at the time the plane crashed. Once a year, they remember them, and the only people that survived the crash are now central to the club. Bobby Charlton, who many of you will have heard of, is the president of the club, and he survived that crash. Central to Man United is this story, and it's something that gives fans something to belong to. And you get the same for Liverpool as well. So for Liverpool, during the 80s, there were fan disasters in Hythe and Hillsborough that have led to Liverpool being the club they are today. From the songs they sing, the shirts they wear, the scarves they all hold up during the certain song. Hillsborough and Heysel are central to Liverpool's identity. And what it means is that if you're a Liverpool fan, you're more than just someone who watches Steven Gerrard on a Saturday, but you're someone whose identity is based around this collection of people who have had awful stuff happen to them. And so when you feel part of something bigger than yourselves, you feel community is more important to you. That sense of community is more important. And at non-league level, this kind of happens in the same way. Because there's less of you, you feel part of the story. You feel like you're important. My friend Chris, who, similar to me, was an Aston Villa fan and left to go and watch a small non-league team, he said at non-league, every fan matters. Every fan that turns up is important to that club, not only financially, but as part of the community of which that club exists. And Mark Berry, who's done a few things around the festival this week, is also on the board at another non-league club. And he says the difference between the top flight and the lower level is that actually at the lower level, you're a participant, but at the top flight, you're a consumer. And I think when we look at the early church, we see the importance of story. We see the importance of narrative. So for the disciples, the story that kind of held that community together was a story that the disciples had lived. They'd seen happen over the last few years. So there's no surprise that they felt part of this story when what they were preaching was what they had seen happen in front of them. They were buying into a story that was real to them. A trainee vicar who was also a football fan said this: I spend half my time thinking about the relationship between football and church, and I think that the shared narrative idea is really important. The biblical stories tell the story of the people of God, which the church today is still part of. Look at the words used in most Jewish homes celebrating the Passover meal. The youngest child asks why they do these things, and the adult talks about how God rescued us out of Egypt. In the same way, when I talk about football, I say how we won the 1946 FA Cup. Making the wider story our story is so important if we want to engage young people in community. And this is where it's exciting, because there's this fight back in football. There's this feeling that the people at the grassroots are getting frustrated and wanting to see and do something new, something different. And I think we can compare this to church. And in my experience, community has done better in church in the small places, again, because it's easier. But you know what? In those big places, those transcendent moments happen, be it at Soul Survivor, be it at big churches. There is a feeling of euphoria, perhaps. And also, sometimes the quality is better. So you might have a better speaker, you might have better flashing lights, you might have a better music system. And you see that in football as well. If you go and watch Arsenal, you see far better football than you do at Kingstonian, sometimes. So then I decided to speak to people in churches about how important community was to them. And here's what was really interesting. There was a real disparity between people under 25 and people over 25 about how important community was. Everyone kind of said, yeah, it's vaguely important. But those under 25, the most important thing they were looking for when they were looking for a church was community. And the thing that they was keeping them at churches was community. Young people are desperate for community. It attracts them to places and it keeps them there. There's a generation gap here, I think, and I think that's because community no longer naturally exists within society. And so for my generation and those slightly younger than me, we're looking to go and find places where we can find that community. And I think it's obvious. Young people are desperate to be part of something bigger than themselves, be it football fans, be it a transcendent experience, or even why young people join gangs. They're desperate to know that they're not alone. They might not articulate this as community, but young people are looking to be part of something that lets them know that they're not alone in this world. And Ken DeCreasy-Dean, who's one of the great youth work thinkers of our time, said that young people are looking for three things. They're looking for fidelity, which is being there. They're looking for transcendence, which is being moved. And they're looking for communion, which is being known. Now, fidelity and communion seem quite obviously placed in community. But some really interesting research spoke about the place of transcendence, of being moved in community. And there's a book called Empire of Dirt, which is all about indie music and kind of cultural marks around there. And there's this idea that in certain places where you stand at a music gig, community is created quicker because of moments of euphoria. So in the moment where the guitar solo kicks in or your favourite song comes on and you're singing along, you end up with your arm around someone you've never met before. And the author said that basically in these moments of euphoria, the social barriers are broken down far quicker than they would be normally. And we also see this in football. Many a time, if my team scored a last-minute winner, I end up hugging someone I've never met before. I hope I'm not the only one who does that when my team's got a last-minute winner. Otherwise, that's really quite embarrassing. But these moments of euphoria can break down the social barriers, instantly affirm and strengthen community. So what does this tell us about Soul Survivor or such like? In these moments of transcendence, when there's something more than euphoria, there's something more than euphoria going on. There's an opportunity. So we need to be seeking out these moments and use them to create community, to allow young people to become part of something bigger than themselves and to show them that no matter how small they might feel, they're not alone. And for me, that's half the power of Soul Survivor. It's not the ministry time, it's not the music, but it's taking young people from a small youth group and showing them that it's not just them and their youth group against the world, but they're ones of tens of thousands of people struggling with the same issues and trying to make sense of their faith in the world around them. Young people need to know that they're not alone. What the world of football shows us is that people are searching for community, but also that in these transcendent moments, moments that transport them somewhere else and can show them they're part of something bigger. And obviously, we shouldn't be trying to replicate a football community, because football communities are marked by who's in and who's out, by what shirt you wear and what shirt you don't. And this is the opposite of what Jesus tried to do when he's trying to bring people into the kingdom. What the church community should be trying to do was kind of summed up nicely in 1 Peter, when he called the church a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that we may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. As a church, we're in a unique position to offer both community and transcendence. And I believe that if you want to create genuine community, we need to invite young people into something bigger than themselves. We need to make our church's story their story. We need to make the Bible's story our story and help them to realize that they don't come to church or youth group to be consumers, but to be participants in a community that exists to change the world around them. Cheers.
Thanks, Jamie. Considering I gave you the worst introduction in history, that was phenomenal. Thank you. We've got some time for some questions. It will be wonderful if you've thought of some. Just to remind you of who is on our panel that you can direct a question to now, we have Jamie, Richard, Jesse Joe, Chantel and Louise. Just before you do that, and you all rush to raise your hands because we have a roving mic, just to remind you, the actual YouthWork Summit, you can find out more about it at a website, youthworksummit.com. We have about 20 of these talks and things and performances through the day, youth workers from and delegates from across the spectrum, and it really is an amazing, phenomenal day. I'd love to recommend to you. It's in West Bromwich in May 2013, the 18th of May. But if you go to that website, youthworksummit.com, there are about 40 or so free video talks like these that you can just watch online for nothing, and I really recommend you do that. So it's youthworksummit.com. Please do that. Do we have any questions? Or are you going to betray me? Ah, right at the front. Thank you.
Hi, yeah, I don't know who's best placed to answer this one, but I volunteer for a local detached youth work charity. It's funded by both the churches and the council, and so as well as addressing at-risk young people, the charity, one of its core beliefs is that actually to bring true healing to these guys, we need to bring them into relationship with Christ. And that is the part of the work that we're funding just so hard at present, and I just wonder if you can point me in the direction of any resources or any things you've seen work or little snippets of advice. That would be fantastic.
I would say join the Street Space Network community. We're in G-Source until 6 o'clock, so if you get your arse in gear, you can pick some stuff up. We specialise in kind of bridging that gap and helping people think critically about, from a missionary context rather than from a kind of getting young people into church context. So how do you grow church in that context and through that context, and what does that look like?
Over here. Thank you. Well, it's a bit sad when you have no questions, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah. On a frivolous note, does Harry have a CD or something?
He's gone.
He's gone.
I don't think he does. I think he will be famous.
Yes. It's
I a think
shame.
Probably.
On
there
YouTube.
Are videos on YouTube.
Ah, right.
And there is a video at youthworksummit.com as well.
Right.
Of okay. him doing something. So.
But a question for Chantel, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name. With the growing number of young people identifying as asexual, how do they fit into what you're doing?
For those of you who don't know what asexual is, an asexual person is a person who does not have sexual attraction to anybody. So typically they do have an ability to have a romantic attachment or a need for relationship. We work with some, actually at Outburst, I'm not sure we do work with any asexual people at this point, but I have worked with a couple of young asexual people in the past. I think all of youth work is about making people feel like they belong, and we would welcome people into our community. And I think enabling young people to develop their sense of identity, whether that be as someone who has an ability to have a sexual attraction or not, I think that's fine. I think what we have to do is make them feel they belong, and they don't fit. They shouldn't feel different. They shouldn't feel other. No young person should feel other. Is there anything else I can? Yeah, and how do we make them feel like they belong in an over-sexualized world? I think the truth is about being honest about themselves and being enabling young people to love themselves. And we talk about that a lot, and I think we could talk about that for hours. But actually, giving them permission to think for themselves, but also enabling young people around them to ask questions without making them feel different, making them feel wrong. I think it is very confusing for young asexual people. And I have to say, there's not a lot of work out there for them. And there aren't many resources, but there are networks online. But I think it's about giving them the permission to work it out for themselves and the young people around them. It's confusing for sexualized young people to meet someone who's not feeling that. But yeah, I think it's about enabling them to think that for themselves and feel good within themselves, even though they might feel different to others. Is that helpful?
Great. Thank you so much. Should we have one more at the back there? If you just wait for the microphone, sorry.
Another hopefully quick question for Louise and Chantel. You talked about not tolerating homophobic language. I'm struggle to know how to react sometime when young people use the word gay as a term of abuse, that's gay. And I've known some gay young people also use the term in that way. And that's left me a little confused as to know how to handle it. And I'd be interested to hear how you respond to it.
It is difficult, especially in my youth group. They'll go around calling each other big gays all the time and other words that might be offensive, that if someone that wasn't from the LGBT community used, might be considered offensive, and they'll go around using them against each other. In my experience from doing youth work with non-LGBT young people, or mainly non-LGBT young people, every time I hear that, I would just challenge it. Like, say somebody said, oh, that's so gay, this pulpit, that's so gay. I go, really? That pulpit's attracted to people of the same sex? And they'd be like, huh? but just to challenge it when you hear it, and just to be... I think when you're open about things and relaxed about things, then it becomes less of an issue. So maybe just to even ask young people if they know what that word means, and if they do, how can a song or an item, how can a song or an item be sexually attracted to someone of the same gender? It doesn't make any sense. And maybe just to challenge the use of the word, and maybe even to point out that when they use that word, it is offensive to people who are gay. It's like calling people who are gay stupid or some of a bad term, because my gut feeling and from my experience, most young people, when they use that word, are in no way intending to offend LGBT people. I don't think that's how young people use the word. I think young people just think that the word gay is the same as the word stupid or bad, and they just use it in that context, but I don't think a lot of them have thought about it. So if you have the time, I think a conversation works well. If you don't have the time, sometimes just a small remark might help. In that situation, but it is difficult, and especially when you have gay young people walking around calling things gay as well, it doesn't really help. But I think if you can challenge it, you should, the same as all homophobic or racist language. And just sometimes to tell a young person they're being homophobic, and if it was more serious than that, you can tell young people that homophobia and those type of things, they're against the law. You can't use hate-filled homophobic language. They are breaking the law if they're being genuinely offensive. But I don't think, to be honest, I don't think most young people are. I think they're just being flippant and they haven't really thought about it. So if you can challenge it when it comes up, I would.
And sort of on a related note, there is a brilliant talk on the youthworksummit.com site from last year's summit, which is free. You can go in, and just watch it on there, by a lady called Ruth Corden, who is the sister of James Corden, which is irrelevant but cool. And she's done this talk on kind of sexualized language and also, as well as that, around the language young people use for genitalia as well. So that's really, it's a great talk. Go and watch it. It's like 8 minutes long. That's all we have time for. Thank you. You've been a lovely audience. I hope that's been helpful. Please do join us at a YouthWorks Summit. But as we end, please thank our panelists one more time.